We're particularly pleased to have you here. I'm sure this will be of great importance to the knowledge of the history of this school and the history of hematology here, and we look forward to having this interview in our collection of oral history interviews, which we have here. I wonder if you would just tell us a little bit about your work before you came here to Washington University, your background at home, what got you interested in this field, and what brought you here.
Well, this goes back a long way, because I wanted to be a nurse, and at that time, I wrote to Dr. Villery Blair about being a nurse, and he told me the field was crowded, and I should do something else.
Why did you write to Dr. Blair? How did you know him, and what was he connected with nursing?
Dr. Blair was a plastic surgery surgeon here that I had seen since the age of 13.
I see.
And he performed, and his associates, about 25 operations.
Uh-huh.
So I was a friend, at least friendly with Dr.
Yes.
Blair,
yes.
As well as he being my surgeon.
Very good.
And so I then finally got, I was out of high school for 5 years before I went to college. Because this was from 1927 to 1932. I guess it's 4 years, 1938 to 32.
That was about the time of the Depression.
That was the time of the Depression, and I had no money.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I finally, my sister took me to Ohio State, and I intended to work on my room and board, but then she decided I'd better not do that. So I lived in a university house that I could do my own cooking.
Yeah, yes.
And so
we're practically co-evils. I know all the problems of that time when nobody had any money.
Well, it's amazing how much you could
do on how little
money you have.
That's right.
And then I worked on Saturdays and got $2 a day to work on Saturdays. And then when the National Youth Administration started, then I got $15 a month as a nurse's aide.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I found out that you got $20 a month as a secretary, as typist.
Uh-huh.
So the next time, I was a typist.
What did your family do, and how many siblings did you have?
There were six of us in the family. I was the third in line.
Uh-huh.
My oldest sister had a degree in accounting, and she was working as a waitress in Philadelphia. And the sister just older than I am was a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
She was rich. She was making $350 a year.
Uh-huh.
And so she's the one who helped me get started into school.
What did your father do?
My father was a farmer.
Uh-huh.
And we lived, though, only about a mile and a half out of Zanesville.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to, my grade school was all in one room, eight grades in one room. So my elementary education wasn't the best.
Well, I'm not so sure, but...
And then I went to Zanesville to high school, which was 3 miles, and usually walked.
Every day, three miles?
Every day.
Winter and bad weather and all the rest?
But my sister, who's just younger than I am, she started the next year.
Uh-huh.
So the first year I went, my oldest sister and I walked together. The second year, my younger sister and I walked together. And many times we had rides because people got to know us and pick us up. And so that... It wasn't
too bad. It was a safer world in those days, too.
It was a much safer world.
Yeah.
So in 1932, I worked, as I said, as a nurse's aide.
Mm-hmm.
Then my second year, I worked in the dean of women's office as a typist. And my final, then 1 year, I worked in the archives at Ohio State University.
Oh, really?
In the... actually, back in the stacks, typing the tax report of 1810
of
Ohio. And so that was
if you ever want to go back to it, we'd be glad to have you come and work in our archives.
Well, I don't know what they ever did with that typed copy that I made, because I had to read from script, and it really was difficult. But so then my senior year, I had worked on NYA and got a job with the home ec department.
Had you majored in home economics?
I was majoring in home economics.
Why did you pick out that subject?
From not being able to be a nurse, I decided to be a dietitian.
I see.
And so this is why I went to School of Home Economics.
Mm-hmm.
In that senior year, the home economics department wanted someone to determine the iron in foods. And Dr. Moore, Carl Moore, was his laboratory at Ohio State was set up to do irons.
He was at Ohio State at that time.
At Ohio State at that time.
I see.
And so I worked on iron in young women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he wanted to do the serum irons in young women, and so he talked the home economics department into getting 18 college girls to submit to serum iron determinations every month.
Oh,
and so I did the serum iron determination in his laboratory.
Chemically.
Mm-hmm. He had worked out this method.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was what he went to do. So the home economics, the iron in the foods, went by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
And but this is how I got started with Dr. Moore.
And with iron. You did a great deal with iron.
I worked many years with iron.
Yes.
And then, during my senior year, I applied for a graduate college in biochemistry at Ohio State and for one in nutrition at Iowa State College. And since I had decided to be a dietitian, I took the one at Iowa State College.
Did you get a fellowship or a scholarship with it?
I had a fellowship that paid me $50 a month.
Oh, that was good money in those days.
And my tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to pay my rent.
Mm-hmm.
Then for my food, I weighed food for a food balance study on one of the students.
Mm-hmm.
And then every Saturday, I would digest the food and the excretions with sulfuric acid and send it off to Iowa City, where it was analyzed for the different minerals.
Oh, they were interested in mineral metabolism.
They were interested in iron and the different minerals.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I made my $50 a month. And so my whole education, including my master's, that I had to pay was $1,450 for 5 years of school. Now, this seems impossible now. But at Ohio State, at Iowa State, I realized I didn't want to work with all women. So I wrote Dr. Moore and asked him for a job. If he had one, I would like to have it. So then he wrote me back. And I just wanted to read you part of this letter that he wrote on May the 6th in 1938.
He was then still at Ohio State, but he was planning to come to
Washington University.
Okay.
And he said, "I've just returned from Atlantic City, where I had the opportunity to talk at great length with Dr. Barr about our plans the next year."
Dr. Barr was the head of the Department of Medicine at Washington University. I'm putting this on for the record.
"I am very happy, first of all, that he was able to get the money for you to join us, beginning September 1st at $75 a month."
Well, that was an increase in salary for you.
Yes.
Half as much as you were making.
"We shall have to do all our own blood counts, shall have to take care of our animals ourselves, as far as special feeding is concerned at least. Shall have to file our own data as we accumulate it and be, in general, handymen." Then up on the next page was this one sentence: "The laboratory should be going at nights as well as during the day. During the spring quarter of each year, it will be our job to supervise the giving of a course in clinical laboratory diagnostic methods to the sophomore medical students. I hope that you and Miss Beerbohm, who was Dr. Doan's head technician and was going to come with Dr. Moore.
Dr. Doan was somebody at Ohio
Dr.
State.
Dr. Doan
University.
Was head of hematology at Ohio State.
Very good.
And that we'll be able to assist in preparing material for laboratory demonstrations. I don't visualize the job at all as a stopgap, and hope that I shall be able to get Dr. Barr to increase your salary to a reasonable level. As I said before, however, it is only fair to warn you that the highest paid technician at the university, to my knowledge, receives only $125 a month.
That's amazing when you consider today's salaries, but I must say that in 1938 I was only making $100 a month also, so I know that this is what very often occurs. So you came to Washington University knowing Dr. Moore. Are you going to give the letter to the archives, Ms. Miller?
I intend to give Dr. Moore's original letter to the archives.
This will be put in the files of Dr. Moore's other material. Thank you very much for the letter. So you knew him before you came, and you came together.
That's right. Actually, he went to Europe in the summer of 38 and came back, and we started September 1st, 1938.
And Miss Beerbohm was somebody you knew from Ohio State also.
I knew her at Ohio State.
Had you worked with her, or you just happened to know her because she was around?
I was a shy little undergraduate,
mm-hmm.
and I knew who she was, but of course I never talked to anybody. And so, but we became very good friends when we got here. And actually, I learned all my morphology from her. She was an excellent morphologist.
She was a technician also in hematology?
She was the chief technician at Ohio State.
I see. And when she came here, I don't know the name in our files. I guess I never came across her. How long did she stay here?
She was married in 1945 to Dr. Donald Bottom, who is in radiology.
Still?
He was in radiology and left here and went to Alton, Illinois, and died 3 years ago.
And she, when she married, she left the field?
She left the field. She didn't do any more after she left the field.
Well, when you came here, what were the topics that you were working on?
I worked on iron.
Mm-hmm.
And I we were working on iron absorption and iron utilization and... That was the two main problems, was iron absorption, iron utilization.
Had Dr. Moore been working on this at Ohio State, I noticed that the first article that you wrote that with him seems to have been number three in a series on studies in iron transportation and metabolism. Had he done number one and two somewhere else?
Yes, he had done one and two at Ohio State.
Uh-huh.
And... But that was before I started.
Yes.
But he was the one who really worked out the method for serum irons.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one who said that serum iron was a transport iron.
What is a transport iron?
A transport iron means that it's going from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
And
takes with it something?
The iron is in the serum.
Uh-huh.
And so it goes...
It is transported.
It is transported.
Uh-huh.
It's transported from the intestinal tract into the bloodstream,
uh-huh.
and then finally it is deposited in the bone marrow to make cells.
I noticed in a number of your first articles you worked on the difference between the absorption of ferrous iron and ferric iron. What was that all about?
Well, ferric iron is not absorbed well.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dr. Moore actually was the first one who said that ferrous sulfate was better absorbed than the ferric chloride.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we tried with vitamin C, and that was absorbed much better. You could take vitamin C and ferric chloride and absorb as much as you did with ferrosulfate.
The importance of this is in the anemias?
The importance of this is that all the drug companies now make a ferrous compound
mm-hmm.
in their iron tablets
yes.
rather than a ferric.
Mm-hmm.
When we first were working on this, we found dogs absorbed ferric as well as they did ferrite, but not humans.
Not humans. I noticed that in one of your papers
yes.
that you said that. I must admit that some of these were beyond me, but I did notice in, you said that in 1944, humans absorb ferrous iron better than ferric iron, but animals are different. Dogs absorb both equally.
That's right.
Got one of yours correct.
And then, we also worked on fortification of bread with iron.
Yes, I noticed that. I wondered that was the only nutrition I saw in the whole bibliography.
Well, I considered iron absorption, that's nutrition, actually.
Uh-huh.
And so that it really was not such a bad jump from home economics into hematology. Because, after all, nutrition is reflected in the blood counts.
Yes, except whenever we think of dietitians, we think of the food rather than the blood.
See, when I went to Ohio State,
mm-hmm.
I was told, really, that I shouldn't be a dietitian because I'd have to meet too many people. And
why is that bad?
Well, because
don't you
of
like
my
meat people?
That's because my face was scarred, you know, from the burn I'd had at age 4.
Oh.
And so you can't hardly dissociate my career from my burn at 4. See, this is why I came to St. Louis to see Dr. Villar-Rivière.
Yes.
And
Do you think they would have thought that today, or was that just a condition of the 1920s?
I think it was a condition of the 1920s. I don't think it would mean so much today.
Yeah. Has it bothered you since, or have you gotten over it?
Well,
I
hardly think about it now.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, when I was young, I did.
Yes, yes.
And so they told me I shouldn't be a dietitian. So then this is really why I went into research.
Mm-hmm.
But goodness, I met as many
I should think you
people
oh,
in hematology.
I'm amazed at the number of people with whom you wrote the articles.
Yes, and no patient ever questioned me.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't think it would have made any difference in the world.
Yes.
Even though if I'd been a nurse, I think
mm-hmm.
it would have been all right.
It probably would have helped you in understanding the traumas that other people
yes,
have in illness.
But at that time, you know,
uh-huh.
it's better, though, than being hidden at home.
I should say. This is one of the reasons they often think people ought to go into libraries, because they're not good with people.
Yes. Well, I have always been pretty good with people.
Yes, I...
But it really has made a difference. I think it made me more ambitious. I think that I really...
It took more courage then after everybody said it couldn't
right.
be done to do it. Well, you certainly have been very successful, so looking
well,
back on it, you can take great pride in how you overcame what other people thought was going to happen.
But I think my family were very good about
supportive.
This.
Mm-hmm.
They never treated me any differently
mm-hmm.
than the other children in the family.
Mm-hmm.
See, there are 6 children, and I was always just treated as one of them.
Were they all your siblings sisters, or did you have two brothers?
There were 5 girls and 1 boy.
1 boy. Uh-huh. Boy was the youngest?
No, he was next to youngest.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And he is an airplane engineer.
Oh, that sounds good.
And worked with Curtis Wright.
Oh, yeah.
And then he moved to Indiana and worked with Allison, the General
Allison
Motors.
Chalmers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you certainly have overcome whatever difficulties you had. In looking over your publications, I get a feeling that anemias was the next thing that you went into, from the iron metabolism to the anemias and various kinds of anemias. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I really, in 45, when Miss Beerbohm got married, I decided I wanted her job. And Dr. Moore told me if I took her job, I'd never get back into research. But I took it because she always told me that it was better than my job.
What was her job?
Was chief technician. And she did all the blood counts and the differentials and all that.
And there would be no research attached to that?
Well, there wasn't really. But I still thought the grass was greener on the other side of the
thing. Probably paid $10 a month more.
And so I took over her job. And I stayed in it till 49. And I saw it was a dead end. And I just really got very restless. And then Dr. Harrington came. And so he was the one who really started immunohematology by giving serum iron, serum. Actually, he gave himself one unit of blood from a patient with idiopathic thrombocytopenia, and his platelets went to zero. And he didn't die from it, but it's a wonder he didn't. See, at that time we could do things on each other, which we
can't do now.
Yes. And he thought it was an immunologic reaction. And this is why we did it. So from 49 to 51, I worked on platelets. Dr. Moore told me I could go back into research and help Dr. Harrington on this platelet problem. So I worked with platelets for about 2 years. Then Dr. Harrington went off to the Public Health Service.
Before we forget Dr. Harrington, that paper which you published with Dr. Harrington about this in the Annals of Internal Medicine for 1953 on immunological mechanisms in idiopathic and neonatal thrombocytopenic purpura is one of the most used articles in this library. When I went to read it, I found that it had been underlined, that there had been comments in the edges of the pages, and that some pages had been photocopied to be bound in. Now, is this an extremely important article, a classic article that set forth something new?
This is a classic article, and the work has stood up under everything.
Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, as I said, Dr. Harrington took this unit of blood from the patient with the idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura, and his platelets went to zero, and he had petechiae, and so at that time he took it. He did it at midnight one night, he and the other hematology fellow, and I was in South America. But I got a return to St. Louis, and he was in the hospital.
He had done what? He had injected himself?
He had injected himself. He
with what?
With this one unit of blood from a patient with thrombocytopenic purpura.
Okay, he thought it was an agglutination reaction.
He thought it was an agglutination reaction.
Okay, and in this article, he concluded that there was more than one cause for idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura. Is that correct?
That's right.
And he listed at least three: the deficiency of the factor for platelet formation, the suppression of platelet formation already there by the spleen or metabolic dysfunction, and the excessively rapid platelet destruction. These were his suggestions. Did he ever follow up? Did you ever follow up on these?
Well, these are really the platelet destruction, the agglutination. And the platelets agglutinate, form thrombi, and then are destroyed. They're taken up by macrophages. And so we work mostly. Now, in platelet production can be decreased, like in aplastic anemia, and the platelet production is just cut down, or they can be destroyed
once they're made.
Once they're made.
Mm-hmm.
And these are pretty well documented.
Yes.
These are the reasons for thrombocytopenia.
Whatever happened to Dr. Harrington? When we left him, he was in the hospital about to die.
Well, Dr. Harrington recovered in about 5 days. His platelets started to go up at about 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And after 5 days, then they really recovered. But those 5 days where he sat up in bed so he wouldn't bleed into his head if he was going to, and it was rather a traumatic time. Actually, two fellows did this at night. Dr. Hollingsworth, who was a fellow on hematology, the same as Dr. Harrington. And the next morning, Dr. Harrington went into the lab and saw he had no platelets and said on rounds to Dr. Moore what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they immediately put him in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he did recover.
Mm-hmm. Without the platelets, he would have died of
bleeding.
Bleeding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, after that, we all took blood or plasma from people with idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura, but we didn't take a whole unit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that we would work to get our platelets just down half. To be significant.
When you say you take, you mean you inject it into yourself.
Inject it into ourselves.
And then when you got it halfway down to zero, what would you do?
Well, then we watched it come back up.
Why were you doing this?
To be sure that this was an immunologic reaction.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
It was quite an exciting time.
I should think so.
And then Dr. Harrington and I worked out this agglutination test in vitro so that we could see if a serum was going to agglutinate platelets it was different than if they didn't agglutinate platelets. Like you had low platelets from lack of production, for instance. They didn't have platelet agglutinates. Were the ones that,
in other words, to identify the cause of the platelet reduction. How long did you work on this in this field?
Worked on this field from 49 to 51, and then went off to Thailand.
Yeah, before we get off to Thailand, unless it's also on this, was that test named after you?
No, I never had any test named after me.
Well, now, Dr. Trotter, sure you did.
No, the only thing I ever had named after me was the laboratory in Turkey.
Oh, how very
and
nice.
And it is still named the Virginia Minnick Laboratory, but no test.
And you also are the honorary member of their society.
Yes,
that's
right.
The Turkish Society of Hematology. Excuse me, you were just about to leave the country when I interrupted.
Well, see, Dr. Harrington was, at that time we had the draft.
Yes.
So he was drafted into the Public Health Service and was in Washington.
Yes.
And I was in Thailand. So the work practically stopped until I returned.
What got you to Thailand? Was there
What got me to Thailand? Well, Dr. Harrington had left, and I was sort of loose end. And Dr. Ben Eisman, who was here in surgery, had been to Thailand and had set up an exchange program with Thailand. And so he was recruiting people to go to Thailand. And so I applied and went to Thailand.
You were there twice?
I've been
2 years?
Yeah.
And
I was there 51, 52. And when I was there, I set up three laboratories, hematology laboratories. I started the filing.
All in Sararat?
No. I did it in medicine at Sararat and in pediatrics and then in medicine at Chulalongkorn University.
Yeah. I was there 10 years later than you, so I know the university.
Yeah. And so when I was there, I went on. We were paid by the U.S. Public Health Service, who gave the money to Washington University. So actually, we weren't on leave of absence. We were just getting
assigned,
paid.
Assigned.
Yes, just assigned to Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
And
besides just setting up a routine laboratory. You did other things there because you published some things on genetics and thalassemia and Kuhn's anemia.
When I was there, we had all these patients with the thalassemia.
Mm-hmm.
And so we worked up these patients, both in pediatrics and medicine at Sierra.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually had a great big board on the, a great big chart on the, a bulletin board, so that we wrote down all the results so that they could see the research that we were doing, everybody. I mean, I didn't want anything under the table.
Were you the only one from Washington University?
No, I, there were, there was a biochemist.
Mm-hmm.
There were three nurses.
All from the United States?
All from the United States. And then there was Dr. Velios in pathology. Dr. Velios graduated from here.
I see.
He and his wife. Mm-hmm. Then there was a bacteriologist from Kentucky or West Virginia. So there must have been three, four, seven of us, I think. And the nurses weren't too busy. So I took over one of them, and she helped me set up the filing system for the Department of Medicine and Pediatrics at Sierra. And I had requested some equipment from the Public Health Service. And it didn't come, and it didn't come. And so that really our methods were pretty primitive, except that they were very cooperative. And we remodeled the lab. Before that, you had to sit at a high table with a high chair to look in the microscope, so we put the tables down so we could put our feet on the floor. And these were beautiful tables,
teak, yes,
all of teak.
I remember.
And then we set it up so that anybody who wanted to come in and look at a slide could. So we did have lots of doctors come in looking at slides on their own patients, the half staff.
Yes. You had gone there specifically to set up the laboratories, or you went there with a research project in mind, or what were you...
I went there, just really, I had nothing in mind of what I was going to do.
And the whole team had nothing in mind, particularly?
Well, we worked at the into whatever field we were in. I had got much more out of it than anybody else, but also put more into it.
Why did you get so much more than they did? I would think they'd all gotten a lot.
They went for a good time.
I see.
I went to work. And we got a lot done because I was ready to come back in 6 months because the equipment hadn't come. It was so hard to get anything done at all. You had to work five times as much as you did here to get that much done.
Yes, I know India's even worse. Did you stay there longer than 6 months? One time you were there for 6 months.
At 6 months, things just started to roll. And so I stayed then the whole year. But they really started to solidify and come and get good results and everything.
What do you think in general about giving sophisticated equipment to countries where they don't have this? Is that likely to be self-defeating in that they're not going to get any more? Or?
I think it is self-defeating to give sophisticated equipment to people who don't know how to use it. Now, when I was there, the Pasteur Institute had put in an electron microscope, and nobody knew how to use it. Now, it was very easy to buy a beautiful examining table. But if you wanted a test tube, you couldn't find one.
Yeah.
It was very difficult.
The Food and Agriculture Administration of the United Nations puts out a little booklet on computers. And the first sentence, computers in third world countries, and the first sentence says, if you don't have any electricity in your country, it's no use buying a computer. And I wonder if sometimes we aren't doing just about the same thing in some of the equipment we send to these developing nations.
Exactly. Now, when I went there, we had used a solid for determining hemoglobin.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no water suction pumps to clean the equipment, to clean the pipettes.
Yes,
we did that all by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had ordered a colorimeter,
mm-hmm.
and it couldn't, never came.
Mm-hmm.
But finally I found out it was in pathology, and they just hadn't turned it over because jealousy between departments. But I finally got it,
mm-hmm.
and we did hemoglobin in a good way then.
Mm-hmm.
But it really, it's difficult. It was very difficult.
Well, you said you worked so hard in addition to actual physical work and getting things done. What the subjects were you working on?
We were working on the anemia that was so prevalent in Thailand. And so when I wrote up the paper, the very first paper of these 32 patients with thalassemia, 34,
mm-hmm.
something
mm-hmm.
like that, the one of the reviewers suggested that this might have there might be an abnormal hemoglobin connected with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had them send me over samples of hemoglobin. When we got our first electrophoretic our power supply and our electrophoresis on
mm-hmm.
paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we found hemoglobin. And this was from samples that they sent from Bangkok. Now, in 52, there were no jets.
Mm-hmm.
And so this all had to come over by...
They sent them here to Washington
They sent
University.
Them here from Washington, from Bangkok to Washington
mm-hmm.
University.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in pretty bad shape, but we knew we had an abnormal hemoglobin.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a doctor in Philadelphia that I thought might have hemoglobin E,
mm-hmm.
or this abnormal hemoglobin. So he sent us some blood, and
mm-hmm.
it was a real good sample.
Mm-hmm.
So we then recognized it as hemoglobin E.
E standing for?
Well, at that time, the hemoglobins were being alphabetized. Every new one had a new letter of the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we found out we were running out of alphabet,
mm-hmm.
then they began to name them according to the hospital or the country.
Or the patient.
Or
in
the
one
patient.
Case I remember
yes.
reading in your
Or the patient.
Uh-huh.
So I worked with hemoglobin then for 15 years.
Uh-huh. And what did you conclude from all of your work on the Mediterranean anemia? And
well, we found out that in Thailand, I calculated or estimated it, that about one out of every four Thai has some abnormality.
Mm-hmm.
with hemoglobin or with thalassemia.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there's, in one section of Thailand, there's 45% of the people that have hemoglobin E.
Now what results from this?
No one knows why there's so much E. Now like with S, hemoglobin S, we think that malaria, that...
Like sickle cell
hemoglobin,
mm-hmm.
that the ones who have it have less malaria,
uh-huh.
but this is not true in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
They have malaria just the same, the E. So I don't think it has to do with malaria, although that's what they thought. But I don't think so. I don't really know why so much E.
When they have this hemoglobin E, what is the result of?
If it's just an E heterozygous,
mm-hmm.
You would never know it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's E homozygous, it's
mm-hmm.
much like hemoglobin C homozygous. There's not much connected with it, not much anemia.
Mm-hmm.
But if you combine it with thalassemia, then it is a disease then, and not just a genetic marker.
Mm-hmm.
And they not only have lots of beta thalassemia, but they have lots of alpha thalassemia. An alpha thalassemia is meaning that the alpha chain is not being synthesized.
When that happens, what the...
Then the gene just does not work, so you're not making that chain.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you get You have anemia.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that you think that when you did the hemoglobin E carriers in the Thai population and used electrophoresis, you found that 13.6% of the Thais you examined, over 1,000 Thais, had the hemoglobin E. But in 213 Chinese, you didn't find any at all.
The ones that have E are the ones in Southeast Asia, the Cambodians, the uh-huh. Vietnamese, and
are they all one
Malayan?
Race?
Yes.
In spite of their
well, I'm not sure they're all one race, but they're political. I mean, they're in some way in the next.
Uh-huh. Well, they've lived in the same area
yeah.
for so long; it would be hard not to have intermarriage.
Right.
You. In 10 members of a family in Thailand that you examined, you couldn't differentiate thalassemia homozygous hemoglobin E from the heterozygous hemoglobin E disease.
This has been pretty well worked out since I started working on it. So that if you have thalassemia, with E, it just means that your chains are not like your alpha chain. Beta chain is not working. It's just not structurally there. Mm-hmm. They're just not being made.
Uh-huh.
And so that if you put E with alpha thalassemia, for instance, with a homozygote, mm-hmm. then you probably have only one gene that's making any anything,
mm-hmm.
and this one gene is making E.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that can be done for these people, or do they?
Nothing except genetic counseling,
mm-hmm.
and that is it.
A hard thing to do in
yes,
any culture.
Yes, that's a hard
culture,
thing to do.
Especially hard if you're not of that culture. You also examined the hemoglobin in newborns. You studied the incidence of abnormal hemoglobins in cord blood.
Yes. They sent me the cord blood.
Uh-huh.
And it had Bart's hemoglobin.
Now
Bart's was first described by Lehman in England at Bart's Hospital.
Oh.
So that's why his name is Bart's.
Uh-huh.
And it's seen only in cord blood, in
uh-huh.
alpha chain abnormalities.
And you thought it might be due to the slow synthesis of the alpha chain?
Well, actually, now it's pretty well settled that it's due to just a gene that is not there.
Oh.
It's not even synthesizing any hemoglobin.
And mostly it's in the Negroes, you said at the time, or
yes,
blacks, as they call
it's
them.
More, it's
now.
More in the blacks than
uh-huh.
it is in
and
the
is
white population.
Is that any relationship
here.
To their sickle cell anemia?
No, I think that they're just more genetic abnormalities in the blacks than in the Caucasians in the United States.
Okay, you continued to work overseas in Turkey. You worked on pica. I hadn't thought of pica for years. What did you find there?
We found that the women were we're eating clay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the clay in Turkey is used for washing clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in every household. You buy it at the grocery store. And the women just take a pocketful of clay, and they take it habit, just much like smoking cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get, they just eat some whenever they feel like it. And the clay itself, in Turkey, is it combines with iron, and I think though the pica comes first. They're eating clay first, and because they're iron deficient,
mm-hmm.
and it just makes it worse. That's really what I think. That they don't get the iron deficiency from the eating of the clay.
They
eat the clay
as a result of
the iron deficiency.
Is that true here in the United States?
That's true here in the United States, too.
Uh-huh.
That the people who have pica here in the United States are iron deficient to start
mm-hmm.
with.
Mm-hmm. And can they be helped by stopping eating the clay?
As soon as they get enough iron, they stop.
They stop on their own.
They stop on their own. Children will do it too.
Yes.
As soon as a child mm-hmm. is, his hemoglobin starts coming up, he stops eating.
Mm-hmm. And if they don't, then what happens to them if they continue to eat the clay?
It's just they continue to be anemic.
Is the clay the same in the United States as in
No, I tested a good many clays,
mm-hmm.
and they're not the same.
Mm-hmm.
Our clay is much less alkaline
mm-hmm.
than the clay in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And so the clays I tried here did not cut down on absorption,
mm-hmm.
where it's much like chelation. The iron is exchanged for the calcium. In the clay.
Mm-hmm. I suspect that these women who are iron deficient also may be calcium deficient, too.
Well, they get plenty of calcium, though, from the clay. They might be, though, but I don't think so.
You don't think so? Because mm-hmm. usually you think of women with many pregnancies as being
calcium
deficient.
Well, and some of them, I'm sure, are zinc deficient, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I expect some of them are calcium deficient, but I was only working on iron.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
You did most of your work on anemia and iron, sickle cell anemia and sickle cell trait and thalassemia and hypochromic anemia.
That's iron deficiency.
That's the same thing.
That's the same thing.
See, I didn't even know that.
Yes. Yeah.
What do you think was the major findings which you did
well,
over the years?
I think probably the best things I could do was set up laboratories, get laboratories going. And I did that in Havana, and I did that in Thailand, and that's what I did in Turkey, was to set up the lab. And I think that that's one thing I can do, is to set up a lab and get it started working. And then I think my other one was the hemoglobinopathies. See, in newborn, I did a big study in newborn here and followed them through until they were over a year old on infants.
And what did you find?
Well, I found out it was, at that time, it was, the theory was the alpha chains were born, all of them that you're going to make were there when you were born.
Mm-hmm.
And the work I did was the laboratory test that really showed this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Is you all your alpha chains are there when you're born, just about all of them. And so the alpha chains would, like if you had an alpha chain deficiency like G. Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
At birth, that G alpha chains were about the same as when you were a year or two old.
Mm-hmm.
So that the, that's one thing I found. And that these alpha chains could also go with the gamma chains, the hemoglobin F, so that you had a new hemoglobin. And they called that hemoglobin F St. Louis. I never called it that.
Mm-hmm.
Because all it was hemoglobin G Philadelphia with gamma chains, which are the chains that make fetal hemoglobin, alpha and gamma.
And you followed these children up until they were a year old.
Yes.
Later on, they didn't change either.
No.
They were the same.
No,
five,
they changed.
5 years, 10 years.
Well,
old.
I haven't changed. I haven't tested any of them at that.
Uh-huh.
But usually, in a hemoglobin G Philadelphia heterozygote,
mm-hmm.
the hemoglobin is not low. I mean, it has no effect on the amount of hemoglobin that you have in
mm-hmm.
circulating. And so it was at the level. It was the
same
all through.
Mm-hmm.
But I think those have been, that has really been what
your,
I have done. That, yeah, my
science.
Contributions to science is setting
well,
up laboratories,
well,
getting
really
other people to work.
And also knowing what is needed as well as all the things you have found
yeah.
out. I also noticed you did some work on mutagenic.
That was my last program, was on after I stopped on hemoglobin, then I worked on audiovisual aids. The 2 years I worked on audiovisual aids. Then I worked on glutathione synthetase and worked out that method for glutathione synthetase with Dr. Majerus's help.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, I did all the tests, but he was the one that suggested I do glutathione, so I did glutathione.
And what did that test show?
Well, it just showed that there takes enzymes to make the, put the glutathione molecule together.
Mm-hmm.
And so we found the first ones, first synthetase that puts the first two amino acids together.
Yeah.
Then there's a second one that puts the third one on the end. It's three amino acids. And I even forget what the
three. Sounds like biochemistry. Yes.
I have done some very sophisticated biochemistry in my lifetime.
Yes, and I wonder how many people realize how good you are at
that. Because I found one hemoglobin, did most of the work on it, you know, and separating it and doing the analysis of it. And doing fingerprinting and for the amino acid analysis.
Yeah.
And so
you
I really said
you did away with electrophoretic methods in favor of a much simpler method of identifying these.
Yes.
So you've really done quite a lot.
Well.
It's very unusual for somebody to spend 40 years in one institution. Did you never think of going elsewhere?
Well, I think these trips elsewhere are the ones that I came back satisfied.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a very good feeling indeed. And how come you never stopped long enough to get your Ph.D.?
I thought about getting a Ph.D.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Moore says, well, why do you want a Ph.D.? You don't need one. And that's really why I don't have a Ph.D.
Do you agree that you didn't need one?
I don't think I need a Ph.D. I'd love to have an M.D.
Mm-hmm.
He also didn't see why I should be an M.D.
Do you think it would have made any difference in the way people treated you if you had either one of them, a Ph.D. or an M.D.?
No, but I think it might have made a difference in my salary.
That's certainly true. And he didn't see that at all, didn't think it was important?
I don't think so.
Is that because he thought women didn't need to be upwardly mobile?
I think he had some feelings towards that direction.
I have heard the stories about him. In general, did you feel that women are treated as well as men here in the
No, I don't
center?
Think they are.
Ever?
Mm.
Not now? And
not
before.
Ever. I don't think so.
Besides, you're not being allowed or given the time or whatever to get your MD or PhD, what happened to you that makes you feel this way?
Well, I have really been very lucky. I have really been lucky to be a professor of medicine without an MD or a PhD.
But that was just later on.
That was later on, but
a little bit after Dr. Moore's death?
Yeah, that was after Dr. Moore's death.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Majerus, you know, was the one that suggested me for a professorship.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it.
And why didn't they give it to you previously?
Well, I didn't get the honorary doctor of science until 72, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can't... Well, anyway...
What do you think that the medical center ought to do in order to treat its women equally with its men?
Well, I think one thing is you knew salaries, which are always confidential, it would help.
Mm-hmm.
But see, they are confidential, so we'll never get that information.
Mm-hmm.
Women will never know what the men are making. And when they do, they get so mad.
Mm-hmm.
But,
is it only salaries that show a tendency to treat them differently, or were there other subtle things that came along?
With me, it's primarily salaries. When Dr. Harrington took over, when Dr. Moore in 19, he took over the division of hematology in 54, and he said, well, this is silly, but I'm getting such a low salary. So he increased, doubled it almost.
more people.
Mm-hmm.
Everything now disposable. We used to have to be
wash.
So saving a glassware, mm-hmm. cover slips during the war. It was just
mm-hmm.
awful. And then money's more free. It used to be very tight.
I wonder if that's going to continue now that the granting programs are being cut down.
I think the ones who are doing good work will continue to get grants. I think they'll cut down grants that are not so important.
Mm-hmm.
But in our department, we seem to have no problems at all. Maybe we will. I don't know.
We'll have to see what the future
we
brings.
We have to see, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you asked me who was here when I came.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Graham was here, Evite Graham.
Yes.
Now, I think the Corys were here, too, at that time. I'm not sure about
yeah,
the Corys.
Well, at least the male Cory was here when I came in 61, so they must have come been here.
Well, I'm not sure. They were here
in the 40s?
In 38.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And then it was Dr. Philip Schaefer, of course.
He was the
dean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Robert Moore in pathology.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure he was here at that time, though. See,
they changed frequently.
Dr. Trotter was here.
Yes, I'm sure.
And
Dr.
then there
Calvary.
Was Dr. Margaret Smith
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Calvary.
Mm-hmm.
And
Dr. Erlanger?
Dr. Erlanger was here, yes.
In general, what were they like? Were they all research minded? Were they all good teachers? Were they generally
Dr. Moore was an excellent teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good teacher, good research, good administrator.
Mm-hmm.
He was really a wonderful man. Honest. Some things I didn't agree
prejudice,
with.
But honest.
But really, he was really an mm-hmm. excellent man. Just mm-hmm. as a man. He was interested in patients.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't interested in getting all that money. And he was really good with patients. And he was a good clinician. And he was a good morphologist, a good hematologist.
Mm-hmm.
He could do his own blood counts and his own differentials.
I didn't realize he'd been in Ohio. What, he comes from St. Louis,
But he had an American College of Physicians fellowship.
I see. Uh-huh. So he was in Ohio just a few years?
He was in Ohio from, I think, about 32 to 38,
uh-huh.
I think,
uh-huh.
about that time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 33 or 34 mm-hmm. to 38.
But while he was here, he got to be father confessor for most of the people in the medical center, I think.
Yeah.
That's why he was first vice chancellor for medical affairs.
That's right.
Was he involved in any way in the feud between Dempsey and Queenie?
I don't know, but anyway, he told me once that Mr. Queenie took 10 years off of his life.
By doing what?
By the contract with Barnes.
Uh-huh.
You know, they worked on that contract for 2 or 3 years, I think.
Uh-huh.
Finally got the contract together. And he worked on that. And then when he was getting ready to retire, you know, he was going to retire.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And set up a cancer center. And he was not looking forward to that either, to doing that.
He was not looking forward to it. Why did he agree to do it then?
I don't know. I think because he thought he had to.
And
I mean, because, you know, he thought it was his duty.
His duty to leave the head of the department for younger people or something?
No, he had to retire, you know, as head of the department. He was 65.
But he could have continued in his research.
He could have continued in his research, but I don't think he wanted to do that.
There was also that escape hatch that the dean could have asked him to stay on until he was 68, I think it was. But apparently that wasn't.
He would have stayed on as starting the cancer center.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He would have stayed on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if he wasn't really very interested in his
classes
as well.
He was interested in it. Mm-hmm. I think he thought it was going to be a terrific job.
Uh-huh. Now, he didn't want such a hard job.
I think that was really it.
Uh-huh. He died very suddenly of a heart attack, I assume.
Yes, he did.
Had he had any previous episodes?
Not that we really knew of.
Uh-huh.
But I think he knew it himself.
I
think he knew he told his nephew that when he that he had had something like an infarct,
mm-hmm,
about 3 weeks beforehand.
Uh-huh.
And I think he knew he had something, but didn't see anybody about it. And he finished writing his last paper.
Mm-hmm.
And this was on a review in nutrition. And went down to the lake to take a swim and got out of the water, and his wife went in and said that he asked for the morphine. He's had such terrific pain.
Mm-hmm.
So then they got him to the hospital,
mm-hmm,
and he died that night. But he monitored his own EKG,
mm-hmm,
monitored everything they're doing for him.
Yeah.
But it really was a shock.
I think, in a way, it was lucky for him to go that quickly.
Oh, yes. That's the way he wanted to go.
Yes,
mm-hmm,
yes.
He once told me that if he ever got any, so he couldn't have control of himself, I had to come in and give him a shot or something. I said, you know, I couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But he just dreaded so much,
yes,
of being like Dr. Sam Grant.
Mm-hmm.
He just never wanted that.
No, I'm afraid most of us are fearful of that kind of thing.
I think so, too. Now, you asked here, are the medical students the same as those in the 40s and the 50s? The 40s and the late after the war, you know, the average age went way up.
Uh-huh.
Our second year class, I think, in 47 was something like 28 and a half years old.
Because they were in the war? They were soldiers in the war?
Mm-hmm. And then came on the
BA,
medicine.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And in the 50s, I don't remember them so much. In the 60s, though, is when they started to lose respect.
Uh-huh.
And I remember Dr. Goldman, the chess man, Al Goldman.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He was lecturing to the students in our class on the chest, sputum.
Mm-hmm.
He's giving the lecture on sputum, and the kids started to make a noise, and he says, now I'll take any of you on that will come up here. And he says, now I was an amateur boxer, and if you're going to behave like that, I can take you on. They did quiet down, but they used to boo.
Yeah.
It was very bad period.
Yeah, I sat in on some of those lectures.
But now, I think they're beginning to go back to looking like doctors and acting like doctors. I'm awfully glad to see them.
Yeah, they're becoming much more conservative in the last few years.
But I taught since 1938.
Mm-hmm.
I started teaching in the laboratory medicine course,
mm-hmm,
and getting the lab prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 40 years, which was enough.
Do you like teaching?
Well, I love teaching. But I like informal teaching,
mm-hmm,
like laboratory teaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I taught, at night a lot, morphology. And my first class were four Army colonels that the Army had sent here, and they worked in the clinics. And they were getting bored, and so they asked me, would I teach them? Well, we had four nights a week, 1 hour a night.
Was this informal?
This was informal at the microscope.
Not the medical school course. This is just one you made.
This is a night course, evening course.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I know I didn't know very much, but anyway, that's how I got started, on evening courses. And I taught evening courses. In fact, I went to Turkey to get away from evening courses.
Oh, my.
That was one of the reasons. And then I taught some in the continuing education for Dr. Brown.
But I'm still interested in these evening courses. Were they official courses?
No, these were. So
you could, did you get paid?
I got paid.
By the students?
By the ones who had taken it. I taught many pathologists, and I taught many physicians.
Mm-hmm.
I taught no medical students in these evening courses.
Yeah.
There were a few technicians, but not very many technicians. Most of them were pathologists and internists.
Well, then you could have stopped at any time you said, I don't want to...
I was getting requests all the time.
Sure, you're a good teacher.
Well, I just hate to say no, I guess.
Well, so you love your work.
I do.
I understand.
But I taught, had evening, I just wish I kept a list of everyone I had taught. I've taught practically every pathologist in St. Louis.
I've had Walter Bauer
and Richard Payne down at Lutheran and Dr. John Bauer out at DePaul. And so I really have, and one at Dr. Gillespie at St. Luke's. But these were all evening courses.
Your own courses. I had not heard about those. That's all news to me.
Well, I have...
Do many people around here give such courses?
No. See, this is why I was so popular, because they couldn't get it anyplace else.
Well, different subjects. Also, they probably make a lot more money so that they don't feel they have to give evening courses, and that was a little extra money for you.
Well, I know one time a group of pathologists asked me what I'd teach them, and I said it would be $20, and so they didn't come. I'm sure if I'd said $200, they would have come. But since I said $20, they probably thought it wasn't worth it. And half staff, they're nothing. And so I really have taught a lot.
I should say. Sounds to me as if the medical school owes you a great deal more than just money.
And then you asked me, did I want to comment on anything else? And the only other thing I wanted to comment on was that I've been the historian and the photographer for the hematology division.
Oh, do they have a history of the...
No, we don't, but I have taken pictures of all the fellows and people who've been here. And Dorothy Moore has a first book. These were actually hematology fellows.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have the second book.
What are you going to do with all your material?
That's it. What am I going to do with it? I don't know.
Well, why don't you give it to the archives or leave it in your will to the archives?
Well, I probably will do that, if it's worth anything.
Are you going to stay in St. Louis?
Yes, I decide to stay in St. Louis. I don't think I'll be leaving.
Well, then you don't have the problem I have, which is emptying my apartment now as I leave the city. But don't wait too long to go through all this stuff and then turn over to us anything you want.
I shall do that. Is Mr. Anderson the one I'd see?
Oh, he's the archivist or anybody in the happens to be there. Well, thank you very much for this. It's been a very useful interview, and I'm sure the people who will listen to it in the future will be very pleased to get it. We do thank you for taking the time to do this. This is the end of the interview with Miss Virginia Minnick on March 25th, 1981.